Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you all for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. So we have our friend Adam tonight from Twist and Shout, who is going to lead our interview this evening. And I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to Adam, and he can introduce our guests.
Hello. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. I'm Adam. I work at Twist and Shout next door. I noticed some of our regular customers here. And I think you all know why you're here, and I think you all know who these fellas are and this brand new book. So we're going to have a little chat for about a half hour or so, and then we'll have some time to take some questions and then and get your books and various other things signed. Larry Lalonde, Les Claypool. They play in a band called Primus. So, first of all, I just want to ask, how's Herb doing?
Herb is doing phenomenally well, actually. You know, the thing about Herb, I'm sure you folks know Tim Alexander had some major heart surgery about a month ago, and you know, he came home one day and was feeling these pains and had this minor heart attack, and we all thought, oh, okay, minor heart attack. And then the next day he went in for angiogram and found that he needed triple bypass, which surprised the hell out of all of us, because Herb's like this super athlete Viking of a man. And so he just had, you know, genetics, sorry, is a bitch sometimes, and he had some issues with some arteries, and they've opened him up and patched him up, and they say his heart is that of a marathon runner, and he's doing incredibly well. So
awesome.
There you go.
Is he still the ginseng drummer?
He may be going back down that path. Yes. He's definitely not eating bacon maple voodoo donuts. So I may be next.
Well, we'll see. Is there a doctor in the house? Okay. You've found certainly an admirable replacement for these few shows in Danny Carey of Tool. You had the first couple shows with him last weekend in Chicago. How were those?
They were okay. Wasn't. It's all right. I mean, you know, it was amazing. We did two rehearsals and then did two gigs in front of tens of thousands of people. Danny is obviously an amazing drummer, but he's also an incredible guy. He's a great guy. And so we've been having a good time hanging and making racket, drinking lots of fancy booze. So
yeah, that's usually what we do with him, is drink booze. So when I look back and saw him playing drums, I was like, hey, you're in the band, all right.
So when you guys all got together to rehearse for these and whatnot, did he come to you and say, hey, here's a song I'd really like to do, or anything like that?
I basically just said, because, you know, it's a tall order to ask somebody to come in and play Primus tunes just on the cuff, off the cuff like that. So I just asked him to go through a bunch of tunes and pick what he wanted to do. And so he did, and then we added a handful of songs as well, and then got together and just ran through them, and the ones that sounded best were the ones we played live, and it was pretty much all of them. I mean, he's good, that guy.
He is good.
And he hits the shit out of those things. It's unbelievable. He's like 8 feet tall, so he smacks things. You know he's smacking them from, you know, many miles away. You can hear it with or without some form of, you know, public address reinforcement. So,
all right, and of course you are in town for the Denver edition of Riot Fest. throughout your history, you've been on just about every festival that there's been in the past 20 years, from the old Lollapalooza and Horde touring festivals to Bonnaroos and Riot Fests of today. What is it about festivals that you all always find yourself on a bill like that?
We are festival whores, is what we are.
Yeah, we're waiting for Lilith Fair to make the next
Lilith
offer.
Never offered us anything. Festivals are fun, you know. We get to get in for free.
That's the main reason we do it, to be honest.
They usually hand you a huge wad of cash, which is sweet. You know, that's usually how I, you know, I live in the country and I go float around in the ocean on a boat and I generally don't listen to much music. And so when I do, it's from 70 years ago. So a lot of times the way I discover new things is by stumbling across them as I'm wandering through these festivals or meeting these people backstage and they go, "Hey, I'm in a band." And I go, then I see them. And sometimes they're good.
Anyone at the Riot Fest last week that caught your eye?
There was this band, Cheap Trick, that was pretty sweet. I'd never heard of them before.
Yeah, don't ever miss Cheap Trick. They're awesome.
Cool.
Are they on this one?
I don't think so.
Not, no. Yeah.
So
you guys are screwed. Sorry, guys.
I don't know if you saw the schedule, but this is, you know, it's a very good lineup and schedule. Just one thing that I think is a slight, you know, Slayer's playing at the same time as you guys.
And yes, we talked to them about that the other day.
So
we talked to Slayer about that, actually. Said, "I'll see you there." No, maybe not.
All right.
We'll wave across the festival.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, if you both, like, crank it up enough, you know, we can get, like, jamming together across the two stages.
I think it'll cancel each other out, you know. It'll be this,
I don't know if it's possible to go above Slayer.
Well, Danny Carey might go
That's
over
true.
Slayer.
That's true. I didn't think of that.
Excellent. Well, event, in addition to Riot Fest that brought us here tonight, is this book. How did this whole book thing come about?
Greg Prado, who wrote it, was doing, I think I was doing an interview with him for Rolling Stone or some publication that he works for, and he just said, "Hey, I'd like to do a book on you guys. Are you into it?" And I said, "Go ahead." And next thing you know, he was working on it. I mean, at least that's how I remember it, but I tend to be a bit foggy on things. And he started gathering names, and with the help of our people and talking to various folks, and next thing you know, we had a collection of anecdotes that tell the tale of how we got to be sitting here in this bookstore.
How do you feel in terms of putting out this career-spanning book at this point in time when you are still...
beginning of our careers?
Still, yeah, you know. Still have some road in front of you, we certainly hope.
How do we feel about it?
Or... sure, yes, how do you feel about it?
It feels good.
All right.
I don't know, what are you supposed to say?
I don't know, man. Ask a stupid,
you know,
question.
Let me think about it. Let me think about it. Let me give it. So, I mean, the amazing thing about it is there are some incredible people in the book saying very kind things about us, and it, you know, it warms the cockles. So, that it's,
and it's I should also say people from a wide range of musical. From the musical world and elsewhere, are in the book.
Yes, Jimi Hendrix says amazing things about us. Maybe I wrote that in there.
Cool. In the book, there are a lot of really interesting stories about the early days and whatnot. So,
We were far more interesting in the early days, so there's the stories towards the beginning of the book are pretty sweet.
Yeah, all the stories about farting, those are...
that seems to be the one that catch on.
Laura, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your pre-Primus career when you were in a band called Possessed. And I always kind of had a hard time in my mind picturing a guy like you in a band like that. And
I'm very multifaceted.
Well, what can you tell us a little bit about what things were like in that band, and then how you matriculated onto Primus?
Hey, before he answers that,
oh no,
does everybody have a copy of the book? Yeah. Can you turn to the photo pages?
Oh no. Get ready.
This is quite possible.
We're going to have you rip
greatest,
this page out and
greatest photo
burn it.
Ever. Turn, keep, I think it's like a second.
It's a second page.
Second
of
page there. There's a picture.
Thanks,
Laura,
bro.
With his chainsaw and his guitar. That is worth the purchase price of that book right there.
And that's the good one.
And also, if you just go back one page, we have this. Nice, young, handsome high schooler here who, another thing that kind of surprised me about the book, reading about your young high school days, seems like you were quite the ladies' man.
I wasn't, but let's not jump off a lure.
Let's stick with this. Yeah, so tell me about this ladies' man
thing. Let's go back to Possessed a little bit. I interrupted your. I wanted to have the people have the visual in their minds from looking at the photo before you delved into Lure's dark.
And I think past. I may have just put
it. Just let me tell you, that picture is what happens when you let a 15-year-old drink Everclear. True.
And so,
You want to ask him if that's real blood in that photo, don't you? That's exactly what you're, or exactly what it is. I'm curious. What is that, Lur? What is that stuff?
That's blood.
Human blood?
Who knows?
All right. Something about Primus that attracted my attention, well, many things did when I first heard your music many long years ago.
So what gave you the impression I was a ladies' man from looking at that? That's the first in my life I've ever heard that.
Well, there's talk about you like sporting a pompadour and
that's why I was hanging out with Hell's Angels. You had to have a pompadour.
You know, all the things chicks dig.
Yeah.
Pompadours.
Pompadours and speed.
All right. Well,
that'll always get the chicks. You know, a nice little bag of crystal meth and pompadour.
Sorry.
After high school, though.
Excellent. Anyway,
that's why David Letterman does these pre-interviews, so the guys don't go off track like we're doing.
we're not on that level yet.
But see, that makes you a much braver individual. Letterman's a coward.
To just walk out here in front of a big crowd of
ends
people
of
with,
people.
With with two fellows who could say just about anything. Anyway, is it all right if we talk about Primus?
Yes, go ahead.
So one of the things that grabbed me initially is you would write these songs about you and your friends, just doing you and your friends stuff, and they would be these epic tales. And you know, we're used to in rock and roll history are, you know, Led Zeppelin's writing about the armies of Mordor and all that kind of
pretty
stuff.
Pretty epic tales.
Yeah. But then we have, like, a song like Over the Electric Grapevine, which is, you know, just you and your buddy hanging out, going on a little drive, and it is an epic quest.
while on LSD.
And I guess that explains it.
What was the question?
The question is, why do you write about stuff like that?
You know, I have a motto, which is, in the early days, you write about, you write over your head, I think. I was writing over my, and the very first song that I ever wrote for Primus, or which was Primate at the time, was a song called Too Many Puppies. And, you know, it's this, you know, it's this anti-war themed anthem I use puppy as a metaphor for a soldier. And there was a time when I would sing that song and think, God, what is this? This is some pretentious bullshit, you know? And as I got older, and now that I'm extremely old, you go with what you know? And if I write about Captain Pierce, the fireman, it's because he was my grandfather. I knew what he knew about. I knew what he did, and that's it. And it's much easier to do such things. I didn't read Lord of the Rings as a kid, so I couldn't write about Mordor and all those things. I saw the movies later on, but it just wasn't my thing, you know. You know, it's like Hetfield. You know, he wrote Creeping Death, and it was obviously he just watched Ten Commandments and then wrote the song, you know, which is great. It's fantastic, but just it was easier for me just to take acid and drive to Los Angeles with a friend of mine than write a song about it.
And we're all glad you did.
There you go.
And something else about the general Primus aesthetic is your sense of humor, worldview, whatnot, has trickled down onto all of your fans. How do you feel when maybe something that was like an inside joke between you and a friend that got put into a song now all of a sudden is something everyone knows about?
Such as?
Such as the picture of me with a chainsaw that now everyone knows about?
Next question.
I don't know. I think I mentioned in the book that a lot of times when we write something, you know, it's me and Lur trying to kind of one-up each other on the humor front. You know, and there's tons of, you know, like you listen to Here Come the Bastards or Los Bastardos on that record, and you can hear these voices in the background, and it's Adrian Edmondson and Rick Mayall from The Young Ones. We sampled them, you know, long before anybody was really kind of doing that sort of thing and threw them on there. And to us, it was hilarious, and to other people, it was just some thing, you know, and people in the know may have recognized these voices, and Dog Will Hunt, you know, that's from Texas Chainsaw 2, and these were little things that were big parts of our lives at the time, and they made us laugh. You know, it made me feel good to have Lur come in the studio and hear this, you know, Dog Will Hunt in just to get see his reaction, you know, and we tend to do that quite a bit, even to this day.
Yeah, there's lots of like put it on the record and like, we got away with that. We actually, that's on the record.
And it doesn't mean shit to anybody else but us.
Yes.
There's a quote that I want to run by you that is actually not in this book, but is a quote from Mike Watt, who is in this book, but in a book called Our Band Could Be Your Life, where he's talking about when him and Dee Boone were young and even before they actually got a band together, when they were thinking of getting a band, and he said, we didn't just want to be a band, we wanted to be our band, us. And that's how I feel about Primus and everything you do, that it's, you're not trying to be anyone else but yourself. And would you like to comment on that?
Well, I've always felt I have a pretty good we call it the cheese barometer, but a sort of a pretense barometer. And things that are pretentious tend to really rub me the wrong way. So, you know, I think for good or ill, whether you love us or hate us, the one thing you can say about Primus is, I won't say everything, because we had our times when you know, the cheese fell out. But it's honest. You know, it's definitely honest. And a lot of it's shot from the hip, which I very much enjoy, and I think Lur very much enjoys that as well. And I think the Brown album is a prime example of that. That was just roll the tape and away we go. And some people love that record, and some people don't love that record. So, but every bit that we do is very representative of that time in our lives and what's going on during that time in our lives.
All right. As you began to get successful, you were in the position where artists that influenced you and you looked up to, like Rush, Tom Waits, Stuart Copeland, became your friends and colleagues. And just like to know if you have any thoughts about that, about how you go from being a kid listening to 2112 in your bedroom to going on tour with Rush and hanging out with Geddy Lee.
I mean, it's a pretty spectacular thing when you meet one of your heroes and they turn out to be an incredible human being, you know, a great person, good guy. You know, I've had a couple of circumstances where that hasn't been the case, and it really kind of sucks, and it ruins their work for me. And it really hasn't been so much in the music world that I can think of as much as like the film world. But you know, so befriending and working with, you know, Tom Waits and Stuart Copeland and the Rush guys and you know, Bernie Worrell and all these different people is a spectacular, wonderful thing. And it's to me, it really defines for me personally what success is. I think that's a wonderful element of our careers. But it also can be kind of frightening because I have had a couple experiences where I've met somebody who I admired and they turned out to just not be that great of a human being. It frightens me sometimes, and I'm not the guy that if somebody's in a room who I very much respect or admire, I'm not the guy that goes up and says, "Oh, dude, I really love your work," blah blah blah, because I don't want that bad experience, because it's just bums out their work for me. And I had a chance to meet George Martin one time, and I don't want to meet George Martin. I can't meet George Martin, because if it's a bad experience, it's going to ruin this huge portion of my life and influence. So I just opted to admire him from afar, and I met his son, who seemed like a nice fellow. But you know, it's even though the people say, you know, love the art, not the artist, it still crosses over, I think.
All right. You have always seemed to have had a whole lot of things going on in terms of other projects, other musical projects, and especially recently, you wrote a novel a few years ago. You made the Electric Apricot movie. Do you ever feel like you're spreading yourself too thin, or is this just doing what comes natural?
I've been too thin, not physically, but I've been spread too thin for about 20 years now. But you know, I think that's what kind of keeps you moving forward. You know, I like to quote, you know, Woody Allen from Annie Hall. You know, for me, being creative, it's you have to keep moving forward, or I get bored. And you know, and like he says in Annie Hall, a relationship is like a shark; it has to keep moving forward, or it'll die. And what we have here on our hands is a dead shark. And not necessarily career wise, it's somewhat hand in hand, but creativity wise, I don't want to have a dead shark on my hands. You know what I mean?
All right. And you, like, even this year, you've gone from Primus shows to Duo de Twang shows and back and forth. Do you have to, like, get yourself in a different headspace, say, when you're doing a Duo de Twang show as opposed to a Primus show?
You know, I've been calling the Duo de Twang project my fuck-off vacation band, because it's kind of what it is. It's, you know, it's me and an old buddy of mine from high school, and I grab an acoustic instrument and we sit on stage with a little campfire, and there's not a there's no big fanfare, there's no inflatable astronauts and screens and, you know, tens of thousands of watts of amplification. And usually we're drinking, but Kehoe's on the wagon now. We're drinking and cracking jokes and just playing tunes, and it's a whole different ball game, but yet it's still very much me, just like Primus or any of the other things, you know. And it's still a very comfortable thing, just like, you know, I mean, me and Lura, we go way back, we're buddies, and so it's just hanging with a different friend, you know.
So Lur, when Les is out hanging with a different friend, what are you doing?
I'm really good at slacking off. See, so I can look at those tour dates when he's with Dota Twang and be like, you know what? I think I'm going to watch a lot of TV that day. And I'm really good at watching TV. I'll challenge anybody in this room to some TV watching.
What have you been watching lately?
I don't know.
Just as long as the TV's on, then...
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what I've been watching. The Weather Channel.
And when your songwriting process, when you have these various different musical outlets, when you do you sit down and say, okay, now I will write a Primus song and it will sound like this, or do you start to come up with an idea of a song and say, hey, this feels more like a, you know, fancy band or whatever?
You know, I'm not really sure. I mean, there's times when I'll come up with something and I'll go, well, that's definitely more of a Primacy type thing, or more of an Oysterheady type thing, even though Oysterhead hasn't done shit in many years. But I think for the most part, I used to say in the early days, like, you know, Holy Mackerel and these things were songs that I wouldn't inflict on the guys in Primus, because the thing about a lot of those songs is it's everything's worked out, you know. It's everything, you know, from the drums to the whatever melodic instrument, whether it's a guitar or a cello or whatever it is, that's all worked out ahead of time, whereas Primus is more of a collaborative effort, you know what I mean, as is Oysterhead. But you know, my stuff, the thing that says Les Claypool at the top, that's me geeking out in a room with some gear and recording most of it myself.
Right on. Well, you've got a pretty interesting project coming up with this new Primus and the Chocolate Factory album and tour. What's the genesis of that?
Well, there was... I've always had this notion of taking on a sacred cow, and there was a few different ideas going around. One idea was, let's do Magical Mystery Tour, which I'm glad we didn't do, because the Flaming Lips are doing Sgt. Pepper's right now, so that would have kind of sucked if us both of us doing it at the same time. But and I hint around in the book about this project, because you know, the thought was I was potentially going to just do it with my band, but we got back together with Tim, and there's this excitement right now in the Primus world that it just felt right that we should do something like this with Primus. So we actually combined elements of, I call it it's going to be Primus and the Chocolate Factory with the Fungi Ensemble, because it's a couple of guys from my last project, which was the Fungi and Foe record. So it's Mike Dillon, and Sam Bass plays on the record, but he can't do the tour, so we're bringing in another cellist. But it's sort of a combination of the two worlds, and it's really came out spectacular. The first notion was, let's try this for New Year's, because every New Year's we do a show in San Francisco and there's always a theme. And in the process, it just fell together and sounded so great. We started recording in the studio, and then it just became, you know, you look at the horizon, you think, okay, what's next? What's going to be next? And there's all these pots on the stove, and you pull one forward, and that's the project you work on. And this happened to be the thing that looked most appealing to put out on the horizon and pull forward to the front burner, whatever the hell other metaphor you want to use, to say we're going to do this thing next. So,
all right. Well,
we've taken on a sacred cow, and hopefully we won't piss off too many people with it. But we like it, so what the hell?
That's what sacred cows are for, you know, to be
Yeah, but Tim Burton took a crack at that sacred cow, and he kind of shit all over it. So.
Well, that's why we have you to correct that error.
I'm sure there's going to be people thinking that we're shitting all over it, too. So, potato, patata, one man's junk is another man's treasure, whatever.
All right. Shortly we're going to throw this out to the crowd and get a few questions, but just wanted to say, get maybe a concluding thought on the history of yourselves and everything.
Okay.
How would you sum all of this up in one word?
Oh, my God. Hypochondria.
Lur, do you have a word to?
It's just fantastic. Terrific.
Won't argue with that. All right. So let's see, Michael. How are we gonna do the question? Shall we just okay. Yeah, I'll repeat it. You, sir.
How did you meet Buckethead, and what was it like to work with him?
The question is, how did you meet Buckethead, and what was it like to work with him?
I've known Buckethead since he was about 19 years old, which was about 40 years ago. And, you know, he's this short Filipino guy who just started hanging around. And, I don't know, I mean, Bucket's one of those guys that's been around us for so long. I haven't seen him in a while. He's kind of disappeared. But it doesn't really seem any different than working with anybody else, except for he can't do shit unless he sticks the damn bucket and mask on. You know?
The first
otherwise,
time
he's like this, you know, total introverted guy. You know, Stuart Copeland always says, because he had this Clark Kent project back in the day, you know, where he put on the masks and do all this crazy stuff, which he needs to do again. You should all urge Stuart, send him emails or whatever the hell you need to do Clark Kent again. We've been talking about it. I am going to play drums, and we want to do Clark Kent again, but he keeps wussing out. But he always says the mask reveals the true self, and that's kind of where Bucket is.
Frightening.
When you first met him, was he wearing his bucket?
He was not. I met him, and my buddy who introduced us, it was actually Joe Gore, who's a fantastic guitar player, said, oh, this is, you know, I won't say his real name. All right, I'll say it. It's Manuel. And he said, this is Manuel, and call him Buckethead. And I was like, all right, whatever. Who the hell is that?
The great thing about Bucket, too, is like when you're on tour with him, he's on the bus, and you're walking down the hallway late at night, and he practices so much, all of a sudden, like, you almost run into something, and he's laying in his bunk with his guitar neck sticking out, and he's just going, blah, 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 blah. You're just like, gee, like, he does not stop practicing, and that's why he's that good.
All right. You, sir.
Good working with Buckethead since he did...
What is this, the Buckethead town?
Wait a minute, that's him right there.
Shit. No, I just wanted to do it on pure imagination. Was that any inspiration for the Chocolate Factory?
No.
You over there.
What
was it like playing with Tom Waits at the Bridge Benefit?
Well, it's a lot like playing with Buckethead. You know what? That Bridge School Benefit, I've seen Tom many times over the years, and I'm not patting myself on the back because I just do what Tom needs to be done. That was one of the best times I've ever seen him, and I got to see him from behind. But it was spectacular. I thought it was one of the better bands he'd put together. It was incredibly fun. The choice of songs was amazing. I don't know if any of you folks got to see any of it, but it was unbelievable. It was definitely a pinnacle point. And I've worked with Tom many times over the years, but it was definitely a pinnacle waypoint in my life and career.
You, sir, by the poll. What was one of the best presents either one of you got when you were 12 years old?
Well, that's my guitar. That's an easy one for me. I was 12 when I got it.
I'll tell you the present I didn't get that I wanted. was I always wanted one of the those damn Evel Knievels that you spin the thingy and he jumps off and he goes over the van. My cousin.
I had one of those.
You fucker. I wanted
guitar.
One. I wanted one, and I never got one. And the thing is my parents were like the, you know, they would, I would say, well, I want this, and they would get me like the, you know, the Sears version of it or whatever the hell. It was always the sort of sub version of it, you know? So there you go. I may have been younger than 12, though.
All right. You, sir, on the end.
What's one of your new favorite bands or a collection of bands you've been listening to lately that kind of popped on the scene that caught your eye and you really dig?
What is a new band that has caught your eye?
Go ahead, Lurk.
This is a band called Led Zeppelin. They're hot. They're killer. I don't know.
I can't think of a single one. And it's not because I'm a prick. I always draw a blank. For 20 years or whatever being asked those questions, I immediately just draw a blank, and I can't think of a single thing. But if I think of it before it's done, I'll chime in.
All right. You, way in the back. Favorite Primus album and why?
That's a good question.
Primus and the Chocolate Factory, because it's brand spanking new. I always like the new babies until I get tired of them. Is they're like puppies, you know? It's like when there's a little puppy, it's so damn cool, and then it grows up and ugly, and it's shitting all over the place, and it's shedding and bringing ticks into the house, and you're like, I'm just getting a new puppy. But and then you look back at pictures of after it's long gone, you're like, yeah, it was a damn good dog. You know? So I think Frizzle Fry is a damn good dog. How's that?
Lur?
I was going to say that one, but since you did, now I'll make up a different answer. Seize the Cheese was interesting just because it was like we just got signed to a major label, so we felt like we got away with something. We finally had a sort of a budget to go record, so we went into a real studio, and people would come by to check to see what was going on for the first time, and every time they would come, there would be some form of nonsense. I think him with a clarinet, me with a banjo. They're like, we gave you guys money to do this. We're like, yeah, isn't it killer? So that was a fun one to make just because there were so many new things, and we're like, probably thought we were getting away with something, or someone made a mistake and sent the contract to the wrong band or something. Cool. And I think now it's Pork Soda that was up there next to Whitney Houston on the chart. That was good times.
Do we have time for more questions? Can we just...
We need way more questions. What are you
keep
talking?
On rolling? All right. We are
questions are the funnest part.
We are going to keep on rolling until someone says stop. You, ma'am, right there. How did you end up in the wine business?
Well, there you go. How did I end up in the wine business? Pure stupidity brought me to the wine business. I live, and we're actually on our 20th year of living in the Sonoma coastal wine country, Russian River Valley. And I was a big pothead for many years, and I stopped because I was beginning to, it was fragmenting my hard drive, so to speak. And I didn't want to not remember what my children were like when they were little. So I stopped, but then there was this purple liquid that kept showing up at my barbecues and whatnot, because it's like living in Hollywood. If you live in Hollywood, you're going to know people in the film industry. Well, I live in the wine country, so I there were coopers and winemakers and vineyard managers showing up at my barbecues and whatnot and around town. And so I just kind of started admiring the local juice, which was this Pinot Noir. And so one day, me and a couple buddies said, you know, we should make our own wine. It'll be way cheaper than buying it every night, which was the single stupidest thing I've ever said in my life. And so we started making wine, and it's extremely good. It's a spectacular wine. We have two of the best winemakers in Northern California. But it's bleeding me dry of any hope of my children going to college. So,
I still have a bottle of the 09 vintage of the Purple Packet. I've been holding on to it.
Now you better drink it.
I bust it out. Let's get it going.
Crack all it right. Open.
Let's have that gentleman right on the end there.
In regards to the blues music, how much the blues influenced your music making over the years?
How much has the blues influenced your music making over the years? Are we talking about the music called the blues or the state of mind?
Well, I mean, the thing is all of us growing up in the 70s didn't even realize how much the blues was influencing us, because we were listening to the guys that were ripping off all the old blues artists, you know, like Zeppelin, who we all love, but, you know, they bit a lot of off of those old blues guys. So I think inadvertently we were influenced in the early on, and then when I was from when I was about 19 till I was about 22, I played in a local rhythm and blues band called the Tommy Crank Band, which was basically, they were kind of like El Sobrani's version of the Blues Brothers. And these guys were all older than me, and it's a couple guys from Tower Power and Canned Heat and these different bands. And so I was just this young vessel absorbing all this information and experience and knowledge and whatnot, not even realizing what glorious treat they were giving me by you know, these guys were all way older than me, and I just to me it was just a gig. But opening for John Lee Hooker, we opened for John Lee Hooker one night. That was unbelievable. It was spectacular. So I think all of us are influenced by the blues a lot more than we actually realize it, you know.
You, sir, in the hat.
I just want to know if there's any plans in the future to possibly work with Katy Perry. I know you did the whole trio thing with Adrian Lewis.
Actually, we're planning on working with him tomorrow night. I don't know. We got pretty hammered the other night, and we were all, we got to do this, we got to do that. So I don't know how much it was drunken bullshit, but... You know, Danny's just a great... If he was here, you'd be going, man, that's a great guy. He's just a great guy. He's a big, happy guy. And it's infectious to be around him. You just feel good. So, yeah, he's a good man. So, you know, who knows? He likes bluffing.
Cheers
liquors.
For Danny Carey. How about you right in front? Favorite venues both to play and to attend a show?
Well, probably the one that everybody says, Red Rocks, is always, you know, boy, every band wants to play there because you see it on TV, it looks cool, and you get there, you're like, dude, I can't believe we're playing here. But
why'd you give it the old,
That's what I was saying. I did the disclaimer in the beginning. I said, you know, that's what everyone
it's
says.
It's a stock answer because it's a fucking badass place. You should relish the notion that you get to go to a place like that. Because
I watched the Flaming Lips, so yeah.
What'd you say?
Oh, yeah. We've seen a show. I said, seen the Flaming Lips.
I watched Sunday, Bloody Sunday, when I was a kid, the old U2 thing. I've watched other bands play that we're on bills with. I mean, Red Rocks is amazing. That wasn't what was going to leap out of my mouth. I mean, I always say Greek Theater, because I was just asked this yesterday, actually, by some dude who has a boat near mine. And Greek Theater in Berkeley is my all-time favorite. And then I followed it up with, you know, playing the Royal Albert Hall was pretty damn sweet. Even though I had one of the worst shows of my entire career the first night we played, because all my gear just exploded in my face just as I walked out on stage at the Royal Albert Hall. But it's the frigging Royal Albert Hall. It's pretty amazing.
All right. You, sir, right there.
Catch any memorable fish this year?
Catch any fish this year?
You're touching on a very sore subject, because it started off, the salmon season started off great. I was 4 for 4. You'd go out, boom, boom, I was doing great. And then went on tour, came back. Me and Wiley Woods went around the corner, and I blew up my starboard engine, diesel. And so it's on the hard right now, having both engines replaced. And like the wine industry... The boat is sucking any chance of my children going to college away from them.
Speaking of the whole fishing thing, you and another great fisherman musician, Dean Ween, have been hanging out a lot lately, and we're talking about making a TV show. How's that going?
Not going very well. We made a TV show, and in fact, some good friends of ours from that are involved with South Park you know, helped us help finance that. We made a pilot and the whole nine yards, and we went to Florida and didn't catch a damn thing, and made this thing, and it's pretty hilarious and interesting, and there's just nobody biting, so to speak, as far as any network or entity that wants to pay to see two musicians go out and fish. So I don't know if you want to write a letter to some of these people. Maybe they change their mind, but
I, for
they're,
one,
they're not into it. The powers that be are keeping me and Diener from fishing around the world.
Have you watched the old show Fishing with John? John
Lurie?
Of
course, yes.
That's a classic.
All right. You, sir, by the pole.
Send us some gear, man. Send it on out.
No, don't do that. Heaven forbid.
All right. We have time for one more question, and let's go all the way to the back. That's you. Have you ever considered playing any B-sides or extreme rarities live?
Well, I was going to say our entire catalog is B-sides. I haven't even heard Poetry and Prose in probably since we recorded it. Is it any good? I don't really remember. What did we started busting out something recently. What it was, The Heckler, we hadn't played in many years, and we started playing that again. Yeah, well, maybe we'll dig something up. I don't know. Yeah, we got to get Herb back on the old horse. When he gets back and we start firing away on all cylinders again, we can dig out all kinds of old kernels out of the...
All right. Well, learn less. What more needs to be said?
Thanks, guys.
All right, we are going to turn this over to the signing portion of the show. Thanks again, everybody, for coming out. And thanks to Primus for being Primus.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.